Hello and welcome back to this Microsoft Virtual Academy on VMware to Hyper-V migration. I'm still Matt McSpirit, and in this module, we're going to be chatting with Barry from NetApp on their solution for migrating your VM workloads from VMware to Hyper-V. So welcome, Barry. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Sounds good. I'm a Microsoft reference architect at NetApp. Some of the things that I focus on is the system center specific integration is Microsoft Private Cloud and everything Shift. So what we'll be talking about here, the technology called Shift. Previous experience, I used to work at Microsoft. So I was at Microsoft for nearly 10 years.
But you escaped.
I escaped. Yep. About 9 months ago, 10 months ago now. Mostly around the System Center products. Operations Manager, I actually started the cross-platform extensions for Operations Manager as the program manager, and then moved on to the product itself.
Cool. So reference architect today, what's TME stand for?
TME stands for Technical Marketing Engineer.
Cool.
So I'm kind of the technical marketing engineer.
So good with colors and also technical.
Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly.
Excellent. Cool. All right. Well, thanks for that, Barry. So we have got a jam-packed agenda today. Loads of stuff to cover in this particular module where we're going to be focusing on NetApp's tools and how they enable you to migrate your VMware workloads over to Hyper-V. So we're going to start with a quick overview of NetApp, if you're not familiar, and then we're going to dive right into the technology, how it works, what the differences are, what the capabilities are between some perhaps other migration tools you may have seen in other modules. So we'll outline the key strengths of this one, and then we'll walk through the solution. And Barry's going to do a cool demo, which I think will really impress you. It's awesome stuff, awesome technology. And then we'll talk about how you get hold of it, which I'm sure you're going to be desperate to know once you've seen the demo and learned a little bit more. And then we'll wrap up with a summary for this module. So without further ado, Barry, tell us a little bit about NetApp, and then we'll move on to the tech.
Sounds good. So NetApp is a storage company. We're one of the largest, I think second largest storage company in the world. We're global, founded in 1992, over 13,000 employees in 150 offices. And our data on tap, which you'll hear me talking a little bit about, is our operating system. That's the name of the operating system that sits within our controllers. It's the number one branded storage operating system out there.
Cool.
We've been partnered with Microsoft for several years, partner of the year last year on server. So this is kind of an eye chart, but just leave it up there for a couple of seconds. But, you know, we've been integrating with the Microsoft Private Cloud, Microsoft Solutions for a very long time, right? We've got huge integration into System Center, Hyper-V, et cetera.
So it's clear to see from that graphic that pre-2008, our integration and the way we worked together was very much focused on the work you did around applications like SharePoint, Exchange, SQL, et cetera. Because you had a lot of technologies like Snap Manager for SharePoint, Snap Manager for the other technologies as well. But then come 2008, that's coincidentally when Microsoft launched Hyper-V as part of Windows Server. And you can see that all of the virtualization related stuff, of which NetApp has a huge amount of experience, has just grown and grown and grown. And that will continue in the future as we add on more capabilities to our respective platforms. Yeah. So there's loads of cool stuff happening there.
Exactly. I mean, we continue to work together very, very closely on what Microsoft is doing as you modify your portfolio.
Cool, excellent. So in terms of the tech, so that's a little bit about NetApp, a little bit about you as well, but what about this, what's the solution? It's because we've learned in various modules throughout this course, we've learned a little bit about different options there are for migration. So what's NetApp doing around migration? How do you do it differently?
Sounds good. So I'll talk a little bit about that, but kind of before I do that, you know, before I get into the design principles, one of the things you'll hear me talking about, you hear me talking a lot of things about Shift. So a couple definitions. You hear me talking about Project Shift, and you hear me talking about Mat for Shift. Project Shift is the collection of technologies that NetApp owns that enable us to do the migrations in the way that I'm going to show you. It is simply a set of IP, some IP, some features and capabilities in our controllers, as well as some PowerShell commandlets that exist within our tools. Those together don't make a tool that actually functions end-to-end. To do that, that's Mat for Shift. So Mat for Shift takes those capabilities and pulls it together into a PowerShell commandlet or PowerShell scripts that will allow you to migrate your VMs from start to finish.
So as a reminder for people, if you've watched the earlier modules where we talked about MVMC, the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter, and we actually also talked and demonstrated MAT, the Migration Automation Toolkit, a lot of acronyms, you're working with Microsoft on developing MAT, a version of MAT, essentially, for Shift, for Project Shift.
In a way. What we did is we took the MAT framework,
yep,
and then we modified it heavily to enable us to do the shift technology.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. When you look at it, you'll see that the menus for Matt are still there, but underneath it's completely redone.
Yeah.
Really done to leverage our technology.
But that's the beauty of that initial framework, is the idea of Matt is a migration automation solution with PowerShell, and you, community-wise, as we alluded to earlier, could modify it completely how you need for your specific environment. And NetApp have taken that idea and just completely customize it specific to that filer. So it's awesome stuff, and as you'll see later on. So that's a good differentiation. Project Shift is to do with the technology. Matt for Shift is more of the conversion and elements around it.
Exactly. All right. So going back to the design principles, really the things that we can do with our technology is we have the ability to migrate and convert these files, these virtual machine hard drive files, without recopying them. So we can do it extremely fast. I mean, just ridiculously fast, to the point where I've been personally called a liar when I demoed it live, because it is quick. So that's really the whole idea behind it.
So when people saw earlier on, when we took a look at MVMC, there's a disk copy involved. And it's depending on the size of your disk, how long is a piece of string, is how long that conversion is going to take. All of your hardware, everything, your network speeds can all play a part. But this solution is obviously very different. It's working at a whole different level, literally, to the way MVMC works at that copy level of the file. So
that's exactly right. And then I'll get into some of the details on how that happens. But really the goal for us was, you know, if we look at kind of an overview of the solution, our goal was to enable as much of a zero-touch migration from ESX or ESI to Hyper-V. So we do things like collect the network configuration, and then we'll rehydrate the VM on the back end. We will collect all the disk information and do the same. We'll remove the source hypervisor integration tool, and then we'll also create the VM. So if everything works well, at the end of the migration, all you really need to do is log into the VM and make sure it got migrated properly.
So a couple of questions on that then. If we're talking about a VMware vSphere to Hyper-V migration there. So the source hypervisor integration tools, that'll be the VM tools.
Correct.
That are running within the VMware virtual machine to optimize it while it's running on that platform. But in addition, you've got considerations about which vSphere hosts are supported, which Hyper-V hosts. Can you tell us a bit more about that? Is there a specific set of hosts that are supported?
Yeah, so there's a long list if you look at our documentation, but in a nutshell, I believe it's from vSphere 4 on.
Okay.
And then for Hyper-V, we'll support all the versions. So if you have a 2003 Hyper-V host, we will actually inject the integration tools into it during the migration.
So 2003
process.
VM running on a host.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So from a modern Hyper-V platform, we're supported. From a fairly recent vSphere, I mean 4.0, 4.1 is a couple of years old now,
yep.
So fairly modern vSphere platform as well, you're in good shape. I think that's going to cover most organizations who are probably still on vSphere. If you're still on 3.5, you might want to upgrade to your later versions, right. I suppose, on that as well, or migrate to Hyper-V.
Yep. So
tell us a bit more about the Matt for Shift capabilities, the product and all the
sure.
components.
So a couple of things as I get into that. Wicked fast migrations, as I mentioned. The reason we can do that is based on a couple of technologies. One is our ability to clone the file. So we don't actually, as you mentioned, do a block copy. We can nearly instantaneously clone the file, regardless of the size. So you know, if you look at in the demo, I'll show quite a large VM that we migrate. But it really doesn't matter how big the file is, whether the file has a lot of empty space in it or not, because we're not doing a block copy. The other thing that we do is we leverage IP that we have to enable us to expose our storage, the same volume, to both the ESX environment and the Hyper-V environment at the same time. So that means that we don't have to copy across storage environments. It sits on the same volume. And those two pieces together really enable us to do this. So as you mentioned, we leverage the Matt framework to automate it. And there's no, currently with the tool, there's no per VM migration costs. Once you have that controller in place,
yep.
You can migrate as much as you want.
And we'll talk more about how you acquire the solution a bit later on, what kind of requirements it has. But what's nice about the solution is it is incredibly fast, and whether you're using dynamic virtual disks, fully provisioned VMDKs, you've got the flexibility there as well. And we'll learn more about that as we go forward as well.
Right. So this slide here, kind of the migration scenario, really what we do is we'll take this VMDK that you see in the green, and we'll convert it to a VHDX. And we have a PowerShell toolkit that we leverage. It has over 1,400 different commandlets that enable you to do pretty much anything that you want to within our controllers. And it leverages this flex clone technology, which is our cloning capabilities. And using this PowerShell toolkit, we can not only clone it, but at the same time modify the VMDK format so that it becomes a VHD or VHDX file. So in one fell swoop, we take that file, clone it, and make it a VHDX file.
So just to explain that a bit more, how does it, because if you look at them in the real, in on a physical system, if you just got a VMDK and a VHDX file sat on your D drive, on your local store, on your local DAS storage, for instance, for all intents and purposes, they may be roughly the same size, but how does that conversion happen? What makes a VMDK unique to a VHDX file from a NetApp and a storage perspective?
So from a storage perspective, it's really not specific. What we were able to do is we were able to take and understand how the VMDK file works and how a VHDX file works and is configured. And we actually go in and we modify the headers and pieces within the file that differentiate the two file types. So right. We actually have the ability to go from one file type to the other very, very quickly. What the magic is, I wasn't a developer on it, so I can't tell you exactly, but I know that there's a bunch of magic that happens within our PowerShell toolkit to perform those.
Secret sauce.
Secret sauce.
But yeah. If you go back to the graphic then that we had on the slide a second ago, we've got these red arrows and these green arrows all pointing to A, B, C, D, E, and F. What's the significance of that? That's obviously on the filer. It's within the waffle file system. So what's going on there? Why are those pointers?
So what we have with our waffle file system, what we have the ability of doing, and this is, again, one of those secret sauces, mm-hmm. is when we clone that file, we're not copying it. We're making a clone. So pretty much we have two files as far as the operating system is concerned. As far as the operating system is concerned, if they're half a gig in size, there's two half a gig files. But in fact, there's only one.
Yeah.
And they share, a majority of the blocks are shared between the two file types. There is a set of components, which are the F on that diagram, that are unique between the VMDK and the VHDX. So our file system allows us to actually look at all the different blocks that make up that particular file within the filer, and say these 85% of them are shared and these 15 are unique. So what we actually found is the difference between a VMDK and a VHDX file is about a meg.
Yeah.
So there's about a meg of data on the disk that is unique just to that VHDX file. As far as the operating system is concerned, as I mentioned, two separate files. So when I go to read one versus the other, the filer abstracts it from the operating system and I can just read that file. Anytime that a shared block between the two files is modified, the file system underneath, the waffle file system, will automatically create a new block with the changes, maintaining the old one for the original file.
Right.
So they will start off as nearly the same file, but once the VM is running and I make changes to the VM in Hyper-V, those files will start to separate. And at that point, we copy those blocks.
Yeah. Right?
But we don't do the block copy off the start.
As a best practice, you wouldn't have both of those VMs as on the diagram running at the same time.
You definitely would not.
No.
They're
that would be bad.
We actually do turn it off at the end.
Yeah.
It is there for a backup purpose, and I'll talk a little bit about that during the demo.
Okay.
But it's only there temporarily until the migration is done, and then it's up to you to remove the original file because it's as the old VM, is going to get stagnant. The new VM is going to get modified. You're going to start filling up your disk space with data that you're not going to use.
Yeah.
Right. So you're going to want to remove those files.
Okay. And we've talked about VHDX as the conversion target quite a few times now. Does it have to be VHDX? Could it be VHD?
It can definitely be VHD.
If you're not running the latest version of Windows Server with Hyper-V, you know, you might not have VHDs.
So. Absolutely. Or if you wanted to convert it to VHD and then use the PowerShell commandlets that exist to upload it to Azure,
yeah.
You can totally do that.
All right.
It's just a setting, whether I want to go to VHDX or VHD.
Okay, and in terms of guests, it doesn't really care from the perspective of it's a Windows client, it's a Windows server, it's Linux, or it's a pretty universal support for guests.
Yeah, on Linux, we're still working on a lot of that, so Linux is somewhat limited today. But from a Windows operating system, it doesn't really matter.
Okay, cool, excellent. Well, it sounds cool. So in terms of that conversion time, you know, you've mentioned a few steps that happened. Talk us through a bit of the process and how long some of this stuff actually takes.
Absolutely, I can do that. So if we look at the conversion task, and I'll go into this in a little bit more detail, and I'm looking just at a 50 gig VM as an example. we do a snapshot, and this is a ESX snapshot. We do the snapshot not for backup purposes, only to coalesce the VM. So we have a stable VM that we can work off of. There's no differencing files in the environment. We just have a single file or multiple files if I have multiple disks to do that.
So the VM is shut down from that. Oh, and it can't
no,
be.
No, it is
be.
Running at that
right.
point.
Right, okay.
So we then go in and we inject some scripts to collect the network and disk configuration. We also inject some PowerShell commandlets that we'll use on the other end once we bring it up in Hyper-V that will rehydrate this environment. So it'll go in and if, for example, your network has custom names or static MAC addresses or IP addresses, we'll reconfigure those once they get rediscovered on the Hyper-V environment.
So you're saying there that any virtual networks are effectively carried over?
Absolutely.
Which is really important, especially if you're converting a lot of VMs. You don't want to have to go and statically IP all of your things again.
Absolutely.
Take a lot of time.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool.
The VMware tools removal actually takes the longest. We perform that action within the VM. And then once we do that, we will convert the disk. We'll convert and clone it at the same time. And then we'll reconfigure that particular virtual machine. So it takes, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 minutes, depending on the size of the speed of the VM and how busy the host is, et cetera. There is one other thing that we do within that 3 to 5 minute timeline, and that is we actually create a full backup of the original VM, and I'll talk a little bit about that and why we do that.
And when you create the VM on the Hyper-V side, so that VM configuration bar that you had along the top there, it's going to be identical configuration. You know, if you had 4 procs before for the VM, you're going to have 4 on Hyper-V, et cetera. Is there any way to modify that, or is it just going to take A and convert to B, and it's going to be identical?
So right now, it's a great question. Right now, it is identical. We just go into the ESX host. We read the guest configuration. We'll recreate that guest on the Hyper-V side.
Yeah, as close to it as it can be.
Exactly. If you wanted to go and modify it, it's PowerShell. So you could go and tweak it, but right now it is a mapping, a one-to-one mapping.
Okay, cool.
So that's conversion in minutes on a single VM. If we actually compare to a tool that I know you've talked about before, the MVMC, NVMC does a block copy, and it does a great job at it. If we look at a 20 gig VM, we take about 5 minutes. It's about 25 minutes for the MVMC. And you'll notice it's about a 1 gig per minute for the block copy, again, average. But for ours, it really does not increase the time. The only time you'll see a bit of an increase in time is if you've got multiple VM hard drives, but you're talking order of magnitude of a few seconds to a minute, not a huge amount of time. So if you have 5 disks, it might grow by 1 or 2 or 3 minutes, but it's not going to grow much more than that.
Okay, so it's clear to understand now that the actual conversion time, the time that stuff is happening, but in your previous graph, we had VMware tools removal, which is obviously an online operation while the VM's running, then the disk conversion. At what point does the VM go down in terms of cleanly shut down and stuff turned off and then things happen on the Hyper-V side? Because that, I suppose, for a lot of organizations is the downtime window. So what's that like in comparison to, you know, the 5 minutes that's discussed there?
So end-to-end, you're probably looking less than 10 minutes.
Okay.
Downtime of the VM will go between 5 and 6 minutes.
Okay, and that's reboot process, getting the initial.
There's a couple reboots in there. There's the configuration. There's potentially a couple of other things. So it also depends, like, how many disks do I have? How many networks do I have? Do I have to inject the Hyper-V integration tools if it's an older version of Windows?
Yeah.
So there's some play in the time, but in our experiences, we haven't seen it more than 10 or 15 minutes at the absolute maximum.
There's always going to be reboots involved in this. There's never going to be, or at least it becomes magical if there could be a live migration from one platform to another. But the realistic scenario is that there's always going to be a reboot as to reflect that change in architecture and
Absolutely.
Configuration. And I think that's very acceptable for a lot of organizations. It can be, for such a small window, it can be factored nicely into a maintenance window as well as a best practice. So for the speed, and which you'll see in the demo, is key there. And you're not consuming extra space.
That's exactly right. And that's really our goal whenever we work on this technology is fit within that maintenance window.
Yeah.
Right? So whenever we do anything, if it's not going to fit within the maintenance window, we find another way to do it or we just don't do it.
Yeah.
Right? So that's always the end goal for us.
Cool. So we've learned a little bit about the conversion now and some of the building blocks that make up the solution around the file system, the filer, and so on. Walk us through the actual scenario that we're going to demonstrate and the general idea of how this process happens.
Absolutely. So as we go through that migration walkthrough, here's what we're going to do. So we actually have an environment that has an ESX. It's an ESX 5.5, I believe. It's running a bunch of VMs. It is already connected to the controller. The controller has been configured. As part of the demo, I'll also show how you can configure that controller. And then there's a Hyper-V environment. In this particular demo, the conversion server conversion happens on the Hyper-V box. But with the tool, we can have another server that then does it remotely.
Is that somewhere where the MapForShift tools are running and stuff? Is that
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So where the MapForShift tools, it can run on the Hyper-V box, or it can run on a separate box talking to the Hyper-V box. Doesn't really matter. Okay. Because we're not copying files at all off the controller, the speed is exactly the same.
So for anyone who's familiar with NetApp filers, are we presenting LUNs through to the vSphere host and Hyper-V with iSCSI? Are we doing Fiber, or are we doing NFS stroke SMB for the Microsoft side?
So,
how is that configured?
So the way that we do it is the controller itself supports NFS in this our example, as well as SIFS or SMB.
Yep.
Again, part of the magic, single volume exposed to both of those protocols. So if I go into ESX, I'll see it as NFS. So if I'm not on NFS, I would have to do a storage vMotion onto that NFS volume.
But no downtime there.
No downtime there.
Yep.
And then I'll do the migration, conversion, and if I need to then take it out to a different controller, if I want to move iSCSI or Fiber or whatever, I would then do a storage live migration. Again,
yep.
No downtime.
Yep.
So the only time there's any downtime is just doing that conversion process. That
just at the end when the reboots happen.
Exactly.
And all that kind of stuff.
That's exactly.
Okay.
Right.
So we store the information. It's on NFS as the starting point. Then what? The backup happens? And
we'll take a backup of the VM. This is our get-out-of-jail-free card. So if anything happens at all, we have the ability to roll back. In fact, we will roll back if we fail. But if there's a catastrophic failure, for example, the conversion server loses power in the middle of the process, I simply need to rename a file and restart the VM on the original one. We make a full copy of the original VM before we do anything to it.
And that's at the filer level. Is that same as the snapshot you talked about before?
No, it's actually, okay. This is our cloning technology. This is our flex clone.
And you're taking a snapshot and the backup.
Correct. Then again, the snapshot is not used for backup purposes, just to coalesce it.
Cool.
Then we'll back up the network and disk settings. We will remove the tools. Convert the VM, and then we'll store the network settings. And there's a diagram here that kind of walks you through that particular flow.
Excellent. Right?
So here's my guest in the VMware environment. I'm going to snapshot it, again, coalescing that VM, making sure I have a nice, solid VM to boot off of. I'm going to clone that. This is my get-out-of-jail-free card.
But again, no extra space consumed.
No extra space consumed at all.
Yep.
I collect all that disk information. At the same time, I inject new PowerShell commandlets into it. I'll also do things, and you'll see it in the demo, where I configure the auto log on so that the VM, when I bring it up in Hyper-V, will auto log on and rerun these, run once these particular scripts. I'll uninstall the VMware tools. We need to do that while the VM is running, obviously, and while it's still on ESX. We'll then shut down that VM. At that point, we will clone and convert the VMDK or VMDKs to VHDXs.
Or VHD.
Or VHD.
Yep.
And that's a good point here is that we will handle multiple disks. So if I've got five disks on it, we'll move over five disks.
Excellent.
We will then create the VM, again, as you mentioned, with the same settings that we had before. We'll mount all the VHDXs or VHDs.
Yep.
We will start that particular VM. At that time, what actually happens is from a MapForShift perspective, we've done everything we can within MapForShift. But we spin off another process to watch that VM to make sure that it's going to perform the rehydration of the network and the disks. At that point, because one of the things that we can do with the MapForShift tool is plug in up to 30 VMs, we'll start converting the next one while the first one is being finalized. We'll reboot that VM one more time, and then we're done.
So perfect timing to see it in action, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yep. So, okay. So let's pop over to a demo and have a look at this in a real scenario. Let's see it working.
Thanks, Matt. So let's jump right into it. So I'm sitting here on the Hyper-V host. I've got the MapForShift tools installed. First things I'll first thing I'll walk through is the controller itself. So as you can imagine, there's a bunch of moving parts in the controller that make this whole magic work. There's probably 20 or 30 different configuration steps that need to happen. And we realize that a lot of the times, even NetApp administrators may not know all the pieces to make this thing work. So what we did is we built into the tool, we built a command that allows us to actually configure the controller for the first time. So what we have the ability in cluster mode to do is what's called a storage virtual machine. It's really a virtualized multi-tenant environment. So I can create this SVM that is shift enabled, and that's what I'm going to use for shift. And I can do this on a controller that is hosting my SQL databases in another SVM or SharePoint or Exchange, et cetera, and do that without affecting any of the other components.
So this SVM, where does it live? Does it live on the filer, or is it on a host, Hyper-V VM?
No, it's on the filer.
So it's like a NetApp-specific virtual machine.
Exactly. It's a storage virtual machine.
Right,
exactly,
okay.
Right. So I go set ONTAP, and I'll do verbose, otherwise it won't return anything. And what it'll actually do is it'll do things like check my elevations, read the variable files and load it, check the versions, connect into the controller. It's going to actually realize that there is no vServer, so it's going to start creating it. It's going to create the shares for SIFS and for NFS. It's going to do user mappings because we're a BSD-based operating system. It's going to do mappings between BSD and Windows. It's going to put in the DNS, create an entry in Active Directory so I can see it through the share. And it's actually going to connect to ESX and mount the data store in ESX as well.
So that just running that one line, it's pulled loads of information. Loads of stuff has come back.
Yep.
It almost seems like magic. Where is that? Where is it getting all of that information from? How does it know to find the vSphere server? How does it know where to get all of that? You mentioned a variable file.
Right. So as part of kind of the MAT infrastructure, there's a variables.xml file. So we've modified that file so that it has a ton of specific information. There's a whole section that talks specifically about the NetApp configuration. And within that, it's got things like the IP address of the controller, the IP address I'm going to give to these volumes, and what share names I want to do, and so on and so forth, and all the information that I need to configure it, usernames, credentials, shares, et cetera. And when I run this, it's going to go ahead and do that. And if I actually connect, this is one that I created earlier. And you can see my DS1, let me zoom in a little bit. My DS1-ESX, that is the NFS part of the volume. And DS2-Hyper-V, that is the Hyper-V side. So if I drill into the ESX environment, I can see I've got a bunch of VMs in there. And if I look at Hyper-V currently, I don't have anything because I haven't shifted anything over. The one we're actually going to look at is this one called TechEd, and I'll show you a couple things about it. I've got several VMDKs. You'll see I've got, let me just get rid of that icon. I've got the dash flat files, and you'll see they're half a terabyte. There's three of them. And then if I scroll down a bit, there's the TechEd dash flat VMDK. That is the OS. That's 52 gigs.
So that's the C drive, and then you've got extra drives
exactly.
For logs, temp, if it was a SQL Server virtual machine, for instance.
Exactly.
Right.
And we...
Common scenario.
Absolutely. We realize it may not be 1.5 terabytes, but we just wanted to show the capabilities of it. And if I switch into my vSphere client, I can see that I've got the tools are currently running. I can see that it's 1.5 terabytes of storage. It's on a network called C-TM. Let's actually log into that particular VM right now.
And that's on an NFS share currently?
That is on an NFS share. Right. So this is my TechEd server, and I'm going to, if I can get control of the mouse, I just have this text file here, and I'll just rename it. Bad demo, something that we can check on the other end.
Thank you.
And then that's the VM. So this is the one we're actually going to migrate. So let's go ahead and dig right into that. I'll bring up a few windows. I'll bring up the Hyper-V environment. I have this window here, which is just going to show me what's queued up, so we can see what it's doing, and then where I'm actually going to perform the actions from, so this folder here. So I can run the MAT for Shift tools in one of two different ways. I can run it interactively, which will give you that MAT menu that you've seen before, or command line. So I can have switches that can form everything that I'm going to show you through the interactive mode. I can do as individual commands, which allows me to script it even further. So instead of just going through it, I can actually For example, use System Center Orchestrator to kick off a bunch of PowerShell commands in a workflow to kick all this off for me.
So you could be automating within automation from other systems.
Exactly.
So it could be broader. You know, you could tie it to Service Manager. You raise a change request, an incident, and say, change request more specifically, I would like to migrate these VMs. It takes that information in an Orchestrator runbook and feeds Map4Shift from there. Essentially, you could.
Absolutely.
I mean, it would be a little bit of customization
required. Absolutely.
What kind of security considerations are there? You know, if I've just got this, I've got my NetApp environment, what creds and stuff do I need for this to, and where do I put them?
So for the storage controller itself, as well as ESX, I'll need the permissions to actually create the storage virtual machine, this virtual environment.
On the controller?
On the controller itself. And for ESX, I'll need the ability to actually perform the actions like execute commands through the tool, shut down the VM, do backups or snapshots of the VM. And that's stored in the variables file. So there's the variable.xml file. All that is stored in that right now. There is a database that we leverage, but that's where we store the network information, the tool versions that we uninstall, as well as things like which VMs are being migrated and what phase of being migrated they're in.
So you mentioned earlier that you can inject some scripts and stuff inside the VM to do some of the network and other related tasks. Do I need special creds for that may be different from the vSphere host credentials?
Yep.
Are they in the variable file?
They're in the variable files as well. So you'll need the, for because it were zero touch, you do need the in-guest credentials. So we create an auto logon for one time where when the VM comes up in Hyper-V, it automatically logs in, executes these PowerShell, and then removes the auto logon, removes all the credentials from the registry, and removes the run once. So that the next time it boots up, it just boots up normally.
Okay.
So going right into it, I'll go in and I'll go into the automation toolkit, and I'll perform a few tasks here. The first one is manage the network. The reason I do this is I can have multiple different networks in the ESX world, and I'm also going to have multiple networks in the Hyper-V world. They're not always going to be the same. So this actually tells the tool how to map the two networks. Right. So I'm going to add a new network. In my environment, they happen to be the same, but in most customer environments, they're not named the same. So I'm just going to put in the name as it appears in VMware and the name as it appears in Hyper-V, and I can give it a VLAN if I want to do that as well. The one thing we talked about automating the automation, one thing I wanted to add to that, we've seen customers use Orchestrator, for example, to add the storage vMotion of this particular VM onto the shift-enabled controller and then pause there, notifying the administrator that it's ready for migration, and then they can schedule it after that. So they use Service Manager to actually watch that workflow, and it pauses the workflow when it's ready to migrate.
Nice.
And then somebody actually does that.
It's the beauty of it is extensibility as well.
Exactly. So now I've got this network set up. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to collect the VMs. So it found 23 VMs. Let me just expand this a little bit here. So it's actually, it doesn't seem like it's doing a lot, but if I was to change the verbose level up higher, you'll see that it's doing a bunch of things under the covers. It's doing things like it's checking to make sure that that particular VM is on the shift-enabled controller. It's making sure it's a supported operating system that we support and we can migrate. It figures out what version the guest is so that we know whether or not we need to inject the hypervisor tools. So it does a bunch of things under the covers. And then it just collects that into the database. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to manage the list that I'm going to actually migrate. And there's a file called vmlist.txt in that folder. I'm going to go ahead and create it.
It's going to create that based on the information it just brought back from.
Exactly.
So does this use the SQL database as well, like SQL
it does.
Express or
yeah,
or
SQL,
SQL?
That's exactly
server.
Right.
Yep. Okay.
So these are all the ones that I found. Because I had migrated the VM before, Teched isn't actually appearing in here. But this is just a text file. So I can go in and I can just say Teched, and that's the one I want to migrate. If I wanted to do multiple, I could just come in here and edit this text file, put the ones I want, and it'll actually migrate that.
Does the order of this list make a difference?
The order is the order that we'll do the migration in.
Right. And is there a recommendation on batch size? You know, if you had 10, 50, 100?
It's a setting within the tool, but you can see if you look on the right here, displaying a maximum of 30 rows. So right now, the default is 30. You could put 40 or 50 in there, but it's only going to do one at a time.
Right, I see.
So we serialize it. What we found is, as you can imagine, as we do this, the cloning, while it happens very quickly, can use CPU resources on the controller. So we want to make sure that, especially if it's a controller that's being used not only for shifting VMs, but also for production environments, we don't want to use a huge amount of CPU on just the migration. So we serialize it. And because it's so fast, it works great.
Yep. And the downtime element of the whole conversion is still minimal. It's serialized.
Exactly.
And you just factor that in. Maybe you do a batch in your first maintenance window, and then the next day, if you've got another window, do another batch there.
Exactly. And then the nice thing about serializing it, too, is as an administrator, if I take 30, I'm going to have to verify all 30. If all 30 are done at the same time, I'm potentially not going to bring those VMs into production until I've verified all 30. If they're staggered 10 minutes or 5 minutes apart, it gives me time to verify a VM, put it online, and then move on to the next one. Take it out of maintenance mode, move it on to the next one. So what I'll do here is I'll actually update the database. On the right here, we'll see that now Tekkit is ready for conversion. If I look in here, I can also, I can see that it's ready to go. And if all works well here, I can now come in here and I can do the conversion. So what it's going to do is it sees that it's going to start the conversion on TechEd. It connects to Virtual Center. It's going to back it up. So if I switch over to the environment, you can see that I
just zoom in there and have a look.
Created a snapshot.
So you triggered the creation. Is that been done at the file level or in?
No, this is ESX. This is that coalescing of that.
Right. But is that a hardware assisted snapshot or is that?
No, this is
purely native.
Pure ESX.
Right.
And now you see I remove it right away, because I don't use it for anything, right? I only use it to coalesce the VM. If I switch into this environment, you can now see that I've already cloned those four files. That's how quick it was.
Can we just zoom in and have a quick look?
Absolutely. So now I can see that I've got this dash mat back. These are the original files before we modify anything.
Okay.
So if something catastrophic happens, I would delete the dash flat and rename the dash mat back to dash flat and restart the VM.
But you're on the file, you're not consuming that extra space.
I'm absolutely not.
Right.
At this point, they're nearly identical files.
Yep.
Let's switch back into. You can see that it's staged the credentials in my environment. It's put the Hyper-V integration install scripts if I needed to, the network restore, the volume. It's saving all the guest information.
So it's invoking VM script at this point, which is the script that is inside the guest?
Exactly. So if I go after the fact, if I go into the guest, there's a C:\mat folder, and I'll see all of these. So if for some reason it doesn't execute, I can go back in and I can re-execute those particular rehydration tools.
So we see that the VMware tools are being removed at this point.
Exactly.
We saw in the graph earlier on of the breakdown of the time and duration of the conversion process that this can consume 2 minutes of the five, maybe even more.
Yep.
Is this a setting that you can say, well, actually, I'm not too worried about that, even though it's probably a best practice. I'm not worried. I'll not bother removing the tools if it's going to mean that the migration is faster. Can you do that?
Absolutely. So within that same variable.xml file that we talked about, there's a variable that's called remove tools. And if you set it to 1, then it's going to remove them. If you set them to 0, it's going to not remove them.
If you don't, however, when that VM comes up on Hyper-V, you'll find that you've got a VM with random VMware services that are playing no beneficial part. So it might be that you disable them at that time in just the services menu, or you maybe modify Man4Shift to disable them, the services.
Absolutely.
I guess you've got, again, the flexibility through the extension and so on. So, yeah.
Definitely. You can see it actually didn't take that long to actually remove the tools, so the tools have been removed. It's now waiting for that particular VM to power off. You can see that if I switch over here, that VM is now powered off. And if I switch over to the Hyper-V environment, there's that.
So that VM is being created. Is, by default, it creating with a Generation 1 VM if it's 2012 R2, or is it creating with the Gen 2? Can it be created with the Gen 2?
I believe it's creating in the Gen 1.
Right,
and
which would be universal to 2012
exactly.
R2.
Again, we're just leveraging the existing Microsoft Hyper-V PowerShell commandlets, so you can modify the PowerShell script to do what you need.
If you wanted to change
absolutely.
It. Yep.
You can see it's now shifting those VMDKs, and it's creating, in this case, VHDXs. So if I switch into this environment, you saw the the ESX environment. Now if I go to Hyper-V, there's my TechEd. So now I have a TechEd folder. And if I drill into that...
And this is over an SMB share now or a...
Exactly.
Share. Yeah.
Now here are my those four drives that we saw before. Again, it's not... It appears that each one of these files, if I look at this TechEd underscore one, there's a half a gig here and there's half a terabyte. And there's two half terabyte on the ESX side. So that's 1.5 terabyte, but really it's less than half a terabyte because I've got one copy of the file with differences between the different clones.
Yep.
So now you can see that VM is running. And we should see it start to, it'll start up and it'll inject. Here's the auto login. There's my PowerShell script being executed.
Very readable.
Yeah, for sure. It's a binary format. So now, as far as it's done, the conversion is completed.
Yeah.
What it's doing now is, you can see here as well, it's restoring the source VM. What this means is, if I was to take the, go back to ESX, say everything ran within Hyper-V, but I found that there's something specific to this VM that caused me some issues and I want to tweak it and shift it again, what we actually do is we go back into ESX and we will replace that dash flat VM, VMDK file, which is now a brand new VMDK file, with the original backup that we created.
Yeah.
So to go back if I needed to, I would turn off the VM in Hyper-V and I would simply start it in ESX.
And that would automatically...
Automatically bring it back to the way
the backup.
It was.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So like if you were to look at the old one, the ESX tools would not be installed. Once I'm done, they will be installed.
So
if I start it.
So one question I've got then, we created the VM on the Hyper-V side, and it would have been VHDX in this case?
Yep.
And that would have been specified in the variable file?
Correct. Actually, that one is actually in the PowerShell.
Okay, but if you wanted VHD instead of VHDX?
It's a switch in the command that we execute.
Okay. But now assume that I want to take that VM up to Azure.
Yep.
What would my process be? Would I incorporate, would I change anything? Is there anything, Matt, that does that? Or would I include, just literally take the disk? And because how you do is you push the disk up to Azure and using either PowerShell or through App Controller, for instance.
Yeah, so today you would just use one of those tools.
Yeah.
We are looking at how do we leverage some of the storage capabilities that we have to optimize that process. And that's something that we're working on. But today, it's a manual process. Once you have that VHD, you would then upload it to Azure, however you would normally do it.
Okay, cool.
And in this case now, I think it's completed. Yeah, so this one completed in 374 seconds. And if I go into this particular VM, so I log into it, there's that Matt demo file that got converted before.
Awesome.
Okay. And again, if I look at local server, it is the same TechEd box that I just migrated over.
So I guess with the hardware change from VMware to Hyper-V, there may be a pop-up that says you need to activate or whatever, but that's by the by with any migration solution,
changing architecture
if you're going from physical to virtual and so on. But fundamentally, you've just literally migrated a VM with 1.5 terabytes of supplementary data in addition to the OS drive, and just while we've been talking.
Absolutely.
And the downtime to that VM was significantly lower than...
Was less than 6 minutes.
Yeah.
And like I mentioned, I did this exact demo at TechEd, and I was called a liar by multiple people. So
I never doubt you, Barry.
I know. I appreciate that. But that's it. And so if I had multiple VMs to migrate, once it hit this particular restoring the source VMDK and it completes that, it'll go on to the next one.
Right.
So it's something that we actually didn't see, but you can see what we do at this point is we spin off another process that's going to monitor that conversion or configuration of the VM in Hyper-V, and that's this getjob-id14. And if I was to execute that, you'll see right now that it's a background job that's completed. If I was to do it while it was converting the next VM, I'd see that it's currently running. It just sits there and watches it to see how long it, whether or not it's done converting. And there's a bunch of different settings I can flip to see how long it actually took. So I can create these reports that will show me each VM how long it took from start to finish, how long it took to remove each component or modify its component. So it allows me to execute these reports after the fact and kind of document with my management how long it actually took to do the migrations.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that. I mean, that's a great example of how you can shift a huge amount of data very, very quickly with just a minimal amount of downtime. You know, an excellent solution. So the question on my lips, and I'm sure everybody else's lips, is how do I get hold of this stuff? I mean, you've alluded to some of it already, some of the kind of requirements, but show me how I get hold of this.
Sounds good. So you can download the tool itself from right now. It's on the TechNet site. So the URL is up there. And it's just it's a zip file with a bunch of the commandlets. And if you've done Matt before, it should be pretty comfortable. You should be pretty comfortable with it.
So that's the Matt for Shift bits that you can download.
Correct.
You can't download a filer from there.
You cannot download a filer. No. You do need a filer.
Yeah.
All right. So you need a controller. If you have an app controller in house, as long as it's data on tap 8.2 or later, and it's running in what's called cluster mode or C mode, then you're ready to go. You do need a couple of licenses on it. You know, it needs to be able to do NFS and SIFS, and it needs to be able to do FlexClone. So those are licenses that go with the operating system.
Is that the same license, or is that two different?
It is two different licenses,
okay.
What we find is most of our customers have kind of an enterprise-type license, which carries them all. But you just need those three licenses.
An NFS for VMware is a very common deployment scenario,
absolutely,
I think, with NetApp. So
absolutely,
chances are you've probably already got that in your environment. But
that's right.
If you've got NetApp technology.
And if you don't have NetApp technology, you know, work with a NetApp rep in your area, and we can help you with getting connected to some of those. And we have a bunch of partners that are working with customers to actually help them migrate.
Cool.
As well.
Excellent. And any other resources you'd recommend? I see some others on the slide there. What's cool about those?
Yeah. So if you look, there's a video from Migration Mark. If you haven't seen this video, you have to watch it. It's hilarious. It's, you know, one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time. And then there's a great report on the Matt for Shift tool from ESG. It really goes into the capabilities and walks you through it.
Excellent. Okay. So that's awesome. We now know how to get hold of the stuff, all of the different pieces we need. So download the bits in terms of the Matt for Shift pieces and get hold of your NetApp controller with the specific requirements you've got. And you'll be able to download the slides for reference as well if you want to checklist these at a later time. But I suppose all that's left for us to do now is just wrap up with a summary. And do you want to take us through just the final closing key parts and key points for the module and the solution?
Absolutely. So in summary, really what Project Shift and Matt for Shift really enables you to very quickly move workloads from ESX to Hyper-V.
Yeah. But also from other stuff as well.
Absolutely. We leverage the data on tap, FlexClone, and very deep. We have a deep understanding of virtualization. We've been working with it for years, working with you guys for years. And then we integrated Project Shift into the Matt tool to allow you to automate it at scale. So really, I can just, we have customers that will go and take 30 VMs at a time, plug them into the Matt for Shift tool, and just sit there and watch it. And then come back afterwards and just test the VMs, and they're done.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for that overview, Barry. Really, really useful. And hopefully it's been really useful for you as one of our core modules within this broader course on VMware to Hyper-V migration. And with that, all that's left to do is thanks, Barry, for his time. And thanks for watching and join us again on another Microsoft Migration module. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.